Cracks Between Two Wings. I'm your host, Emily Norman. And today we have Pete Zaccanino, who is a jet and sport class race pilot who's walked away actually with four championships from the Reno Air Races, along with various other accomplishments in the racing world. Pete, thank you so much for coming on Between Two Wings today.
It's my pleasure to be here, Emily. Thanks for the time.
Of course, I'm looking forward to talking about some really cool things that you have done. You know, you have accomplished so much, and I'm a private pilot, only really flown two aircraft. So I thought I should, you know, make myself look more interesting by having a ton of planes behind me. This is actually from the Boeing Museum of Flight. But what have you got behind you right now?
Behind me is my current jet class race plane. It's a highly modified L-29, and it has a bigger motor in it, or it'd be very slow, frankly, for a jet. And some other modifications, some classified, only our team knows about.
Yeah.
And others everyone knows about, because there's been a few planes that have emulated this idea.
Yeah, we definitely won't tell all your secrets on Between Two Wings, so all good there. But not only do you race aircraft, you are really interested in the building, the designing, you know, the actual flying, the test flying of it. What is it about each of those aspects that, you know, really does it for you?
Yeah, I mean, I like the creative side to a lot of things, and I enjoy that in aviation as well, because I think it's a highly accountable exercise to creatively come up with designs, whether it's an aircraft or just a part or a modification, a new inlet, new cooling system or improvements to a cooling system. And then you go up and test it as the test pilot and support that. And then you're completely accountable for it, which is, I think, an important attribute to a successful person is accountability. And that embodies all of that. So you get to, you know, design a part or an airplane, possibly assist through the fabrication. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. And then go out and test it. And if it works, great, you're a hero. And if it doesn't work, you know, you got to own it and say, well, that was a waste of time.
Yeah, definitely. That accountability is huge. And, you know, there are instances where it hasn't always gone right. I know you've experienced a lot of engine failures through test flying. You know, what are some things that you've learned from that? And then also, how many have you actually experienced?
As far as engine failures specifically, I've had upwards of 23 plus, depends on how you count them too. because if the engine quits and you get it back on, I don't think that really counts. but real engine failures down to the ground, yeah, it's about 23 or 24. I think the biggest thing is preparation on every single flight you do. If I'm going up in a friend's Cessna 150, which I'm happy to do, and we're taxiing out, I'm going through my head, and I'll share it with another pilot if they're on board. What am I going to do if the engine quits at 300 feet, 400 feet, 900 feet? Let's have some gates to go through so we know. You know, if we're in a Cessna 150 and the engine quits at 300 feet, we're landing straight ahead on the runway or the remaining amount of the runway. You know, if it happens at 900 feet, that's probably a turnaround, which is a hot topic right now, and head back to the opposite runway that we took off from. If it's a jet, that's a different animal, and we have to think about it differently. And even if it's not a single engine jet, I have several thousand hours in single engine jets, but also in twin engine jets, you need to have that in your head. And I think every professional minded pilot, doesn't have to be a profession, but a professionally minded pilot, is going to have that scenario ingrained into their head. And it should be rehearsed every single takeoff. And that planning goes a long way for success. I've had various outcomes, and only one I've had to put it in the desert after the ultimate. That was three different Maydays. But the third one was finally because the engine was not providing power when I needed it most. So I had to put that plane in the desert. But the others have been successful outcomes, meaning the plane was reusable after we found the problem with the engine and got it back to the runway.
Yeah, for sure. And I know you have a pretty well-known mentor who may have given you some words of advice for these situations.
Well, that sounds like a brag.
It's okay. I set it up for you. All good.
Yeah. When I was doing my undergrad in engineering, I walked over to the fence and asked Bob Hoover to come over and talk to me for a minute. And he was super gracious. You know, I was this dopey 20-year-old, and he came right over, and we had this 15-minute conversation. And he was like, "Well, Peter, why don't you come on around? We'll talk about things." And we did. And then he basically critiqued an air show routine I did about 12 months later. And he asked me very pointed questions and things like that. And a year later, I ran into him at an air show, and he remembered me. And that was really flattering. I was like, holy cow, this guy remembered mm-hmm. me, you know? And then we start talking about crash survival and stuff. And over the years, you know, I've been with him throughout different events and everything else. And he's always been great. But he said, you know, a famous phrase, he was like, "You keep flying that plane, don't stop flying that plane." And it was true. And one of my worst incidences that was multiple failures, and I put the plane in the desert. It was in my head. I know that sounds cliche, but I was flying it. When I hit the desert, I kept flying it because I didn't want it to flip over. And I did. I used the rudder and the elevator, and finally the plane made a slight turn at the end and it stayed upright, and I got out. And it's a long story, but some rattlesnakes were chasing me around the desert, and you know, it was quite entertaining in hindsight. And
did he have any advice for, you know, fly the plane to the ground, but then avoid the wildlife and all the other things to come?
There were several people who have given me crash survival advice over the years, and no one's talked about the wildlife. So I might pass that along to anyone listening. Consider the wildlife that you're landing amongst.
Yeah, that is very true. So going into a little bit of the racing that you have done, how do you get into racing? What is the process? I know it's invitation only. How does it work?
Well, it's invitation to race after you successfully completed Pylon Racing School and called PRS. And we also refer to it as rookie school. And I've always said to people, think about it as a rookie testing with a little bit of school, because you're expected to show up with very good formation skills, knowledge of your aircraft, and the ability to handle your aircraft in an emergency. And then you get some training on how to race and our race rules and procedures. But there's a high amount of requirement expected of you. And we've had success and school failure by everybody. Very experienced pilots have failed. Very experienced pilots have succeeded. And vice versa, we've had guys that are, you know, lower on the experience level, but they've worked so hard in preparing for it that they've done fantastic jobs at racing school and they've been invited to race. And so what normally happens in June is people come out for a formation warm-up, and that's about 3 days. And it's technically not a part of the racing school, but it happens right before it. And then we finish the formation clinic, which is good for everybody. Everyone needs a warm-up. And then we go into race training or racing school. And it's a lot of academics. There's a lot of ground school. There's briefings. And then we go up in small flights. And it's a building block technique. We start out in 3 and 4 ship formations. We're expected to be able to do a flip-flop and strong formation skills before we even enter the course. And then we teach them on how we're going to enter the course. And we lead them out. Again, it's a building block technique, and we want to show them the race course in a follow the leader type of fashion so that they can find the pylons. And even experienced guys sometimes can miss the pylons. There's 10 of them out there. And after they've gotten some level of comfort, then we start doing simulated races, and then we do simulated failures, engine failure from the race course, things of that nature. And if they do all of that, they take some check rides and we evaluate them. We want them to be safe for themselves and for their peer racers. Then they get a letter of invitation to come race as a rookie in September. And it's a cool experience.
I can imagine. And then, so the races themselves, let's go into that a little bit, you know, the atmosphere, the way it works, then also the racing in general.
The race week at Reno specifically, not to exclude other races, but it's pretty involved, and it's involved if you're racing in one class for sure, because you have to get your plane there. You have to deal with weather and all the things pilots have to deal with that you know about. And then it's, you show up, you sign in, you get, credentialed, then you, we start the big briefing. We call it the mass in briefing. And you begin with the mass in briefing. And that takes a few hours. And once we complete that, then we start the practice and qualifying. So you have to go out and do X amount of laps to practice and also get your G tolerance a little bit established. And then once you've completed that, we have, depends how you look at it, but roughly three qualification periods per class. And there's six classes. And you go out there with other racers, but you're going to have a clean racetrack, meaning you're not going to have to fly behind another aircraft that could be getting in your way or causing turbulence. And you're going to call for the clock. And my recommendation is you get two laps. And you take that qualifying lap and they give you a time and that stacks you into where you will pair with the other 24 racers. And the top eight will be in the gold for that class. In our example, the jet class. And then the middle eight will be silver and the remaining eight will be the bronze class or the bronze category. You can move up if you find speed in your airplane or you're flying better or all the above, you can move up. But the following Sunday from when we start is the final gold Sunday. And that's where you will take your position for the final race of the year, hopefully in first place.
Yeah. And so obviously speed is a really big factor here. How are some of the ways that you have increased the speed in your aircrafts and that you've seen other people do as well?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of reliance on power for good reasons. Your power and your engine and what it can do and thrust. I think that's probably number one. However, I think there's a lot of overlook in weight and drag reduction. There's planes out there that are fast that aren't as, in my opinion, as careful about weight and could be even a little bit more careful about drag as well, because weight slows you down. And those are important areas, you know, obviously the engine is, but you also have to finish on Sunday. You know, if you have this big, powerful motor, but it's so amped up that it can't finish because it's breaking or you have issues, what good is it? So you also have to have reliability, which is a product of how much power you're asking out of your airplane, you know, especially in the piston planes by far. With the jets, you know, we're limited. If you turn them up too much and increase the power, you're going to melt motors. And that's an expensive way to go home on the back of a truck.
Yeah, then you're no longer racing.
And then you're no longer racing is right. And that's a frustrating year.
For sure. And I know, you know, there's the big changes where it comes to reducing weight, increasing power, but what are some of the small nitty gritty things that people do just to add a few knots here and there?
One of them is how you fly the line, as it's called. And that's the course line on the track, because wind affects that. And, you know, you really got to think through how a bigger wind or a different direction is going to affect how you fly your line around the, you know, in our case, in roughly 8 mile track. And if you just fly it the same way, you're going to end up pulling more G's in certain places and that kills your speed. And any control deflection is affecting your speed. And of course we have to fly, but if you're over controlling in the race sense of the phrase, that's going to impact your speed big time. And I've seen people with fast airplanes whose speeds are impacted, including me. I've had bad days just like anybody. And I've had, you know, my lap speed, not so good because I was like, what the heck was I doing? You know, and I've had days where I've been right on and the laps are predictable and consistent and my speed's higher, you know, and that's a big factor in how you fly that course line.
Yeah, I can imagine. And so your top speed is what, like 529,
I believe? Yeah, 529 is my official top speed, yeah.
Oh, there you go. With any note on your unofficial top speed?
Rumor has it there was a 560 lap.
Oh, my. So why does that even feel like?
Your brain's doing things a little differently, I think. People think often that, you know, you're in a very amped up state. For me, I'm in a very calm state, which is, I guess, my personality, but I don't get all like amped about it. It's a busy head game. And in the jet class and some of the other classes, people have said, you know, how many laps do you do? And it's six laps per race. And they're like, oh, wouldn't you like more? I'm like, hell no, I don't want any more laps. That's just plenty.
Yeah.
And you're hot because, you know, all the vents are sealed off and the cockpit's upwards of 120 plus degrees and all those, you know, hero stats. And, but it's an uncomfortable environment you're getting beat up in.
Oh, I can only imagine. And what are some of the takeaways that you've learned from, you know, doing this kind of extreme conditions of flight versus when, you know, you're in a slower aircraft, just cruising out, maybe going to grab lunch at an airport, not trying to beat anyone or be the fastest out there?
I think it just contributes to the professional side of flying. You know, it's not golf. I mean, golf's a great game, but, you know, in general, golf's not going to kill you. And so even as a hobby pilot, you know, I think there's still a professional sentiment. It doesn't matter if you have 60 hours in a Cessna 150, you still have to apply a very disciplined, professional approach to it because of the consequences. And I think racing reinforces that to a very high level that, you know, if your focus is on the paint job and not on the maintenance, that might be a bad attitude, you know. Is it better to look good or feel good, you know? But I think it just reinforces the impacts of a lack of discipline and a lack of professionalism, both in, you know, on the ground, how you treat your peers and your fellow racers, helping them, the camaraderie, being comfortable with them, being trustworthy with them, helping them. It all adds to the safety environment. And I think that's really important part that is applied to basic flying as well, or, you know, airline pilot or corporate pilot, whatever you're doing. It just reinforces that really.
Yeah, it definitely comes back to the fundamentals for sure. So earlier you kind of tapped on the fact that you like to, you know, use that creative side that you have, and that has actually led you to writing a few books.
I've enjoyed the creative process and more than I thought. There's a story I wanted to tell. And I thought, oh, you just write a screenplay, and, you know, present it to Hollywood and they make a movie. Well, it's not quite that way. And it led into converting the first screenplay into a book, and I titled the book Relevant. And it's a quick elevator version. It's a military spy thriller based on CIA assets and that type of world with a lot of history and background information. But it's a creative process. Even if it's factual based, it's still, to make it readable, make it into a story that people don't want to put the book down, basically. And, first time you do anything, it's harder. And, it was a challenge, and I really enjoyed the process. I was like, well, looks like I'm making a second book. So I did. And that's the new Cold War. And, it's both have done really well. So, halfway through the third and fourth book right now and writing those, I've been writing them semi-jointly. And, I really enjoy it. I mean, it's cool.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm going to look into those. I already have for Relevant, and definitely in my cart right now on Amazon.
Cool. Thank you.
Pete, thank you so much for coming on Between Two Wings. It's been so great to talk to you. And next year I'm getting to the Reno Air Races, so I'll see you there.
Sounds good, Emily. Appreciate your time.
Of course. And thank you everyone for tuning into this episode of Between Two Wings. We'll see you next time.